You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
April 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. A happy Easter and Passover to you today. A little late on both accords, but I am back from my vacation today on the post show. How much did I lose in Las Vegas? How was the convention? How was my vacation? You'll hear about the new fire pit I built. Did I contract poison ivy over vacation? What movies did I see? Will you hear about my Easter bunny past in the post show? Perhaps you will. Or how about how 7 days of matzah eating has left my colon completely bloated? All that and more. We will take your calls today. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We will take your calls after we talk to Sam Stein of the Huffington Post. 646-257-3920 to call now. You'll be put on hold. You'll be first in line when we take calls. Let's jump right in. Sam Stein will help us catch me up on what I missed last week. But this story, these two stories right here really caught my eye. Republicans are not only satisfied with cutting $1.6 billion from the EPA in the latest budget, but in the states, Republicans are also looking to destroy the environment. In Maine, Paul LePage announced a 63-point plan to cut environmental regulations shortly after he was sworn in, including opening 3 million acres of the Northwoods for development and suspending a law meant to monitor toxic chemicals that could be found in children's products. This from the New York Times. Governor Rick Scott of Florida proposed eliminating millions of dollars in annual outlays for land conservation, as well as cutting to $17 million, the $50 million allocated in last year's budget for the restoration of the dwindling Everglades. You won't need those. Just a bunch of weeds and water. In North Carolina, Republicans control both houses of the legislature, and they're looking in their recent budget proposal to cut operating funds to the state's Department of Environment and Natural Resources by 22%. All of this Republican onslaught on the environment, and it is with that backdrop that I give you some good news. Finally, a Republican who is paying attention to what is happening to the environment, who has noticed that global warming is having a direct impact on his state. This is a little bit shocking, I know, to hear a Republican who actually cares about this stuff. But I want to read you a proclamation from a couple of weeks ago. And, well, it starts with this. Whereas the state of Texas is in the midst of an exceptional drought, with some parts of the state receiving no significant rainfall for almost 3 months, matching rainfall deficit records dating back to the 1930s. Dust Bowl time, folks. Dust Bowl time. Whereas a combination of higher than normal temperatures, low precipitation and low relative humidity has caused an extreme fire danger over most of the state, sparking more than 8,000 wildfires. Whereas these dire conditions have caused agricultural crops to fail, lake and reservoir levels to fall, and cattle and livestock to struggle under intense stress, imposing a tremendous financial and emotional toll on our land and our people. Now, therefore, I, Rick Perry, Governor of Texas, under the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the statutes of the state of Texas, do hereby proclaim the 3-day period from Friday, April 22nd, 2011, to Sunday, April 24th, 2011, as days of prayer for rain in the state of Texas. Finally, this man deserves a round of applause. Finally, we see, yes, everyone's impressed. Finally, we see a Republican governor realizing the dire situation the environment is in and is taking proactive steps to change the environment, to protect the environment, to help the environment by asking us all, at least in Texas anyways, to pray for those 3 days. I hope they did it. Do we have a weather report for Texas? Has it worked yet?
I'll get you one right now.
See, that's what's called good governance, folks. And that doesn't cost anything, those prayers. Although, you know, while you're there, you could put a little kitty into the, a little into the kitty. Help your mega church out. Maybe if he had done it a little bit earlier, some of those Jews in Texas would have thrown in a prayer for rain, too. No word on whether or not he's calling for rain dances or anything like that. But kudos to Rick Perry for finally showing some leadership. Weather report?
It's a nice 76 degrees in Dallas right now with no precipitation.
All right. May have to have another round two of prayers. All right, folks, we'll take a break right now. We'll be right back with Sam Stein from the Huffington Post. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Some breaking news. This just in. It seems Rick Perry's proclamation for 3 days of prayer may have some impact. We are looking at possible thundershowers in Dallas this week. So we will keep you updated on that. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome to the program Sam Stein, political reporter from Huffington Post. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Really glad to be here.
Sam, I want you to catch me up on what I missed. I've been on vacation this past week. And now, first off, let me start with, I know Sox, 8 out of 9 wins. There's some talk that Saltamacchia is not the drag on the rotation that we thought he would be. If you have anything to add to that, we can talk about that. We can jump right into the political stuff.
Yes, I think I'm really upset with Dice K, even though he's turned it around, because he's giving my dad early life heart attack. He's so schizophrenic, and while he's pitched brilliantly the past few times, I just wish there was a touch more consistency with his outings. So I'm not ready to forgive him just yet. But beyond that, I'm happy with the turn of events for the Sox.
All right, so I think we just made some news. Dice K, not doing enough to assuage the Stein household?
No, not even close. We need at least five more of these outings.
All right. So with that said, what were the three big stories this week that I missed while I was luxuriating with my family on vacation?
Luxuriating, very nice. I think the big one, obviously, is what sort of the pre-arguments to what's happening over the deficit ceiling and the debt ceiling and whether it's going to be lifted. And you have a bit of maneuvering from both sides of the political aisle here with cresting in the Sunday shows with the GOP saying, well, it's not going to be that big a deal if we hit the limit. Of course, it would be a monstrous deal. You have the Gang of Six talks for the uneducated or the people who actually have a life and don't have to pay attention to this stuff. That's a group of three Republicans, three Democrats in the Senate. They are in discussion to introduce their own deficit reduction platform. No one knows exactly what's going on. It's very hush-hush. There's a sense that it's going to be something slightly less than progressive, I guess would be the way to put it. And then
Gang of Six, we have Dick Durbin, who is supposedly the progressive stalwart, coming out saying that he buys into Tom Coburn's horror stories of what happens if we have continued deficits, and he's talking already about Social Security cuts.
Yeah, and it's sort of, you know, there's two pictures here. One's the broad, one's sort of the micro. The micro picture has to do with Social Security, which, you know, if you look at any of the metrics, it's not in trouble. It hasn't contributed to the deficit. You can go through the arguments that are always made. But if you have people like Dick Durbin joining in sort of the hysteria over its long-term finances, and, you know, that says something about the state of the conversation. The bigger issue is the notion that, you know, we have basically a Democratic administration, and basically every Democratic senator in the Senate now fully bought into the notion that it's the age of austerity and we should be tightening our belts and so on and so forth, and it's just a question of how tight we want to make it. So, you know, there once was a talk of whether we needed more stimulus, and that seems sort of quaint right now when you look at Washington, D.C.
Well, the jobs picture is so much rosier now than it was then, right?
I mean, yes. Yeah, exactly. We're not in double digits in terms of percentage of unemployed, so we can all just go back to our daily lives, right?
Now let me ask you this. Is Dick Durbin essentially a surrogate here for the Obama administration? I mean, I know there's also some talk that he is angling for some type of leadership role, perhaps in a post-Harry Reid world, and he's sort of angling in a slight Cold War with Chuck Schumer. Is he functioning as Obama's surrogate here? Because there's every reason to believe that the Republicans would have to capitulate on this on raising the debt ceiling. And in fact, they've stated it. Leadership has stated it multiple times. But it could very well be that Obama is using this as an excuse to further his grand bargain.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's like tons of personal drama and great backstory to it. And it involves both Durbin and Obama, but also Durbin and Schumer. And, you know, how does Durbin, because recall, you know, when the calendar year changed and the losses in 2010 elections, Schumer was elevated to sort of de facto message leader alongside Harry Reid, and Dick Durbin, who was still number two in the caucus, was kind of left behind. So there's been speculation that he's doing this as a way to seem less as the sort of token progressive in the Senate and more like a serious individual, whatever that means. But at the flip side, you can't sort of dismiss the idea that, you know, everyone in the Democratic Party right now is talking what Dick Durbin's talking, basically. Social Security is the outlier, of course. There are good chunks of Democrats who don't believe that you need to discuss Social Security in this context. But, you know, Dick Durbin is not, you know, unique here. It's pretty much every Democrat. What's surprising to me is that from all indications, the Gang of Six won't talk about raising tax revenues or taxing the wealthiest in the country at pre-Bush levels. And that's sort of like an obvious compromise right there. If you want to actually go after entitlements, well, then on the flip side, you need to raise more revenues. And if that's not even on the table, then I'm not entirely sure what type of bargaining we're talking about here. I mean, it seems like that's sort of the script of the Republican Party to begin with. So
right.
I'm not,
I mean, they,
really
they
sure
seem
where
to
the
be,
game is exactly going.
What they're talking about seems to be actually to the right of Simpson Bowles.
Exactly. And I'm not, and you know, it's easy to get confused and speculate because there's so many different committees here. Now we have Joe Biden's going to host his own deficit discussion at the Blair House. And, you know, this is just like classic almost self-parody Washington here with a committee just, you know, discuss what the other committee is doing. So it's easy to get ahead of the conversation, but you're right. If it's, there's no tax revenue increases, then it is to the, it's to the right of Simpson-Bowles, and it makes Simpson-Bowles look sort of, you know, moderate.
And so,
welcome back.
Yeah, really, thank you. Nothing has changed in my week of absence. When do we anticipate this debt ceiling vote to take place?
This is what last week I did this story, and you know, it seems like the writing's on the wall right now for the Republican Party to basically draw this out as long as they can. And the big concern among a lot of Democratic officials on and off the Hill is that, you know, if they just simply, you know, wait, and then the Republican House members, Republican House leadership, introduces a bill that would allow the debt ceiling to be lifted on the condition that you have, let's say, caps on discretionary and domestic spending, well, you know, how is it possible that Democrats don't vote to pass it? Because they clearly want to make sure that the debt ceiling is raised. They're on board saying we need to raise it. So I have a sense that this thing's going to wait until either late May or June. I think Tim Geithner said that they can go till July 8th is the latest possible date. So we could get a really late vote on this, and as an attempt by the GOP leadership to essentially jam through various policy riders that they want.
And there's no way for Democrats to, I guess, preempt that by just offering a bill to raise the debt ceiling because they don't control the House.
Yeah, I'd have to. I'm not a parliamentarian here, so I'm guessing that because all spending bills originate in the House, that it would have to start in the House. I'm wondering if the Senate could do anything to sort of set the stage for this, because they could theoretically introduce a bill, make it a clean one, force them to vote on it, and see what happens. But I'm guessing that it has to originate in the House, and this is where, you know, the 2010 elections have real consequences. Any spending bill basically has the imprint of John Boehner on it.
Right. A nice sort of like, I guess, a tan in a bottle smudge, as it were.
Exactly.
So what else you got this week?
You know, there's crises overseas. There's a war in Libya. Syria is shooting its own citizens. You know, usual quaint foreign policy stuff. And then this morning, actually, the firm that was responsible to was going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act on the behalf of congressional Republicans has quit the case, and the chief counsel on the case, Paul Clement, has actually quit the firm. So,
wow.
You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. Supreme Court this morning dismissed an effort by the Virginia Attorney General to essentially fast-track the health care lawsuit. So that's going to take its normal course. And, you know, it's never a dull day in Washington.
And you had a piece that was interesting to me, that Obama's deficit speech was actually planned months in advance. What are the implications of that?
You know, I mean, it's from my vantage point, and I talked to a couple administration officials and people on the Hill. You know, they have this notion in the White House, and maybe it's not you know, all that far-fetched, that they can't get anything done domestically in terms of legislation without at least sort of mitigating or moving the deficit talk off of center stage. And so what you get is, you know, the president basically touting, for instance, all the cuts that were contained in the continuing resolution that he signed. And then you get him making these grand speeches and inserting himself into the debate so he can at least have the veneer of being a very serious deficit hawk Democrat. The reason I wrote this piece is because all you heard from the Hill was about how they were never consulted about the speech and so on and so forth. And it turns out that, you know, they weren't consulted, but this wasn't sort of a last-minute, you know, improv effort by the White House. It was something they had been planning out for a while. So the strategy of actually tackling the deficit is one that the president's advisors have really gamed out. But you don't really see them getting any benefit of doing it. In fact, when they agree to cuts in the continuing resolution, it's never good enough. The cuts aren't big enough. And so, you know, you have to question whether there is a long-term, you know, strategic vision here, even though they seem to be sort of going down this path anyway.
Or you have to question whether or not there's a long-term effective, either their long-term strategic vision is ineffective, or in fact, maybe their goals are slightly different than what one would expect of a Democratic president.
Yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense. But you know, keep in mind, there was a template for this, and it was sort of seen with the debater of the Bush tax cuts. So the president clearly, or at least he said, he didn't want to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. He campaigned on it, drew lines in the sand, so on and so forth. And then he punted on it. And why did he punt on it? Because he wanted to get a deal done on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and on the START treaty, in part, and also because he wanted to get unemployment benefits extended, and he was willing to make that compromise. And so you have sort of a pattern of a White House that's routinely willing to sort of adopt more conservative economic thinking in exchange for, you know, some domestic legislative priorities. And I'm curious to see what they actually get from coming out and making a big speech about deficit reduction, because, like I said at the beginning, you know, there once was a school of thought, and it still does exist. You don't hear from it much, but that, you know, actually we could use more stimulus right now.
And what do you think that they want? I mean, at this point, you know, Jared Bernstein is gone from the administration or is headed out the door. He was sort of the last vestige of any liberal voice that would be supposed progressive voice that would be pushing for a perspective on the value of trying to tackle the deficit when you have this type of unemployment and you have an economy that is underperforming for the vast majority of Americans. What could they be looking for?
I mean, there's a whole host of things. They seem almost, you know, comedic in terms of how far away it's possible to envision them being passed. But, you know, basic energy reform is something that they've been pushing forever. And they've scaled down their visions, and they've given in on nuclear power and offshore drilling. But, you know, the thinking in the administration is that so long that everyone's talking about deficits and hysterical about spending, that they can't get stuff like energy policy done because no one's going to be able to work on it, or at least the Republicans won't have any desire to work on it. And it goes to this longstanding belief inside the White House that if you just placate the GOP critics a little bit, that you'll get something in return. And I have yet to see that actually work, save for Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the START treaty. But, you know, those were never those shouldn't have been that all that controversial to begin with.
Well, Sam, I think you've just about convinced me to go back on vacation.
I'm sorry. Well, that might be good for you, actually.
Yeah, I think I could probably use it. All right. Well, Sam Stein, thank you so much for catching us up on those big stories this past week. Love to do it again sometime soon.
Definitely. Appreciate it, Sam. Take care.
All right. We got to take a break, folks. When we come back, a couple more stories. You can give me a call at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or Skype at Majority Live. We'll be right back after this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back, and we have breaking news from our meteorological desk. Matt, why don't you fill us in on what's happening in terms of rainstorms in Texas after following Rick Perry's proclamation that everyone should pray for rain in Texas?
Area of Texas. storms and hail last night.
Storms and hail last night in the Fort Worth area of Texas. Congratulations to you folks in Fort Worth who were praying for that rain. Somebody threw in a prayer for hail, apparently. Not cool. Not cool. But what are you going to do? I guess that's if that's what it is, that's what it is. All right, let's we'll get to your calls in just a minute. 646-257-3920. Let's go. First off, let me talk about this WikiLeaks. There was a big WikiLeaks drop I guess yesterday. And on information about the prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. And frankly, you know, I've been reading through this and I don't see a tremendous amount of information there. These are reports written by essentially officials who were holding these prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. The New York Times somehow got a hold of these reports, these WikiLeaks documents, but not via WikiLeaks. It's unclear how they got a hold of them. I'm going to dig through them a little bit more, I want to dig through them a little bit more and talk about them in the coming days. But frankly, on first glance, I'm not seeing a whole lot of new information on these. We will talk about that more as we go along. Let's go to the phones. We got Avant on the phone. Welcome to the program, Avant. How are you?
Hey, Sam. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. Folks don't know who Avant is. Avant, of course, is the guy who provides us not only with a lot of our great graphics on the site, but he also does the daily roundup of the show. Avant, you didn't have much of a vacation, did you?
I do what I can for you, Sam. I'm trying.
I appreciate it, buddy. So what do you got
for me? I think it happened over on your vacation, so you probably didn't miss it. But there was a report from the they threatened to bring down our rating, U.S. ratings from Standard & Poor's, because
right.
Our debt is getting too high. So I thought with everything going on, it would be great to reread Shock Doctrine from Naomi Klein, just because it seemed to really, you know, what she has there is really a roadmap of actually what's happening now. So I found a real quick thing, if you permit me to, it's only a couple sentences, but I'm pulling
Please.
From there. But it's perfect of what happened in Canada in the early 90s. So she wrote, the phrase debt wall suddenly entered the vocabulary. What it meant was that although life seemed comfortable and peaceful now, Canada was spending so far beyond its means that very soon, powerful Wall Street firms like Moody's and Standard & Poor's would downgrade our national credit rating from its perfect AAA status to something much lower. The only solution, we were told, was to radically cut spending on programs as unemployment insurance and health care. Sure enough, the governing Liberal Party did just that, despite having just been elected on a platform of job creation. Canada did have a deficit problem, but it wasn't caused by spending on unemployment insurance and other social programs. I mean, it's perfect. It's exactly what's happening now.
Yeah, Avant, you're absolutely right, and I appreciate the call, buddy. I will talk about that right now. Thanks for calling.
All right.
So Avant is absolutely right. On Monday, I guess it was, of last week, Standard & Poor's came out and basically threatened to drop the U.S. debt rating, and was met with virtually no serious concern. In fact, I think James Galbraith, who you'll recall was on this program some time ago, talking about the implications of the debt, and he laughed. And it's a joke because, first of all, Standard & Poor's, as a rating agency, knows nothing about the debt or deficit that is not public knowledge. Secondly, their proclamation, and Avant's absolutely right, not only did they do this in Canada as per the shock doctrine, they did this in, they threatened Britain with dropping their debt rating. And, of course, the difference is that we have a the world's currency, and that there's no one really paying attention. PIMCO shorts treasury bonds, but they're probably doing it because they anticipate that there'll be some tightening of the Fed, which is the Fed has been talking about that, by tightening meaning essentially raising the cost of borrowing money. And so if you short treasuries, you're basically playing that spread. If interest rates on treasuries go up a little bit, then your PIMCO, 1 or 2%, then you've made a lot of money. But there's been no reaction by people who lend money to this country. And as evidenced by any rising of the interest rates of these treasury bills. Even this is from The Economist. Buying patterns indicate that there's a growing demand for treasuries and that the end of Fed purchases, as you know, they've been involved in what is known as QE2. Most people feel like it hasn't had too much impact. $600 billion worth of purchases of debt, essentially, of treasury bonds. And there's no indication that the Fed purchases, the easing of that, the ending of it, will lead to a big jump in yields. In other words, they won't have to raise the interest rates to make lending money to the United States Treasury more attractive. Japan has essentially said that it's not worried about American borrowing. China is increasingly vocal about its concerns. The problem is China has very little leverage because they hold so many of those T-bills. And they don't want them to become worthless. So there's no economists who are taking this so-called debt crisis seriously. Everyone agrees that we are about 6 percentage points, 8 percentage points above our debt to GDP ratio in terms of helping with growth. But no one believes that this is a crisis that cannot be managed in the future. The IMF projects that America will grow consistently faster than Europe over the next few years, which will close the deficit and debt. We are at all-time lows for taxation. I've said this 1,000 times. All-time lows for taxation, as measured by percent of income, as measured by percent of GDP. There is plenty of revenue out there for us to raise that would in no way be historical. In other words, we could come back up to just the levels that were pre-George Bush, and we would close the deficit in half tomorrow. The Economist says, quotes Gillian Tett, "American yields are low, not because American debt is winning a beauty contest, but because it's losing an ugly contest. There's no sure, safer investment than lending money to the United States. And as long as bond holders or potential buyers believe that, and there's every indication that regardless of what the S&P rating agency says, they still believe that, we have no problem. If we needed to cut things, we could cut things like American military spending." And over the next couple of days, I will talk more about the people's budget, which is gaining a little bit more traction. One wonders why we don't see more of this in the mainstream media. No, one doesn't wonder that, but it's something to point out. It's the largest caucus in the House, the Progressive Caucus. They put out a document that actually closes the deficit, if you feel we need to do that, still provide stimulus, and they do it by ending our two wars. They do it by introducing things like a public option and Medicare's ability to actually negotiate for drug prices. They do it by raising taxes on the rich and some elements of the middle class. So it's definitely doable if it's necessary, but nobody serious thinks it's necessary except for our political leaders who have been cowed into this belief. With that said, and this is encouraging, and I want to advocate for all of you to go to your local congressman's town hall meeting. And hopefully some of this audio will inspire you. I'm sure maybe some of you have heard this already over the past week. What's that? No, we'll get to it in a second. Will you turn up the Sammy Cam volume for a second? number 646-257-3920 or Majority Live is our Skype handle. 646-257-3920. I'll take more of your calls in a moment. Let's listen to, I guess this started off the week. And tellingly, both of these clips are from Wisconsin, because I think folks in Wisconsin have become, I think the electorate has simply become far more attuned to what's going on in this country because they felt it there first. We have stories all across the country of people going to their town hall meetings with Republicans and questioning them on Paul Ryan's budget, questioning them on their refusal to raise taxes on the rich in this country. And, you know, one of the things that I hope will happen with this program, eventually my intention is to simulcast this on live radio, knock on wood, but with the size audience that we have, that is in the tens of thousands as opposed to hundreds of thousands of or millions that we had at different times at Air America, I'm hoping that you people will be more informed and will actually go out and do this stuff. And if you head to your Republicans town hall meeting, bring a video camera, bring an audio recording device, send it to me. Not only will we play it on this program, we'll make sure that it does the rounds. So let's listen to Paul Ryan booed at his own town hall. This is, I think, a six-term congressman. Booed at his town hall this week because of his refusal to recognize that we have the lowest taxes per income, per GDP, any way you want to measure it, on the rich in this country, and frankly, just about everybody in this country, federal income taxes, in the past 60 odd years. So here's Paul Ryan from last week.
History has shown that concentrating more wealth at the top has been the worst thing for our
economy. Hold on, stop this for 1 second. I should tell you that this is the first voice you're going to hear is one of his constituents. And it's great to see the video images of this. And we'll put the video up on our site. Because all these guys are in hunter gear.
Yeah, before the clip came on.
You got to put a wire into your microphone before you speak. We've all been on vacation in our minds.
Yeah, I've been coming in. I've just not been thinking about it. Before we cut this clip, in the larger video, this guy identifies himself as a lifelong conservative before going into this conversation.
Yeah, I think people in Wisconsin in particular are far more attuned to what's happening to them. And maybe this is the key, is to start to focus on this stuff on a state-by-state level. Let's try to start it up again. Number two.
History has shown that concentrating more wealth at the top has been the worst thing for our economy. Statistically, this logic has shown that to work and is the worst case scenario. I think one of the biggest mistakes we can make is to forget history. And the share of the total income going to the richest 1% of Americans peaked in both 1928 and 2007. And what happened the following years after that? The Great Depression and the Great Recession. Conversely, our economy has been less robust and the middle class has had a greater share of the wealth and more disposable income to take their wife to a movie or pay their kids bowling. And the middle class is disappearing right now. During this time of prosperity, the top 1% was steady at about 10% of the total annual income. Yet today, we are fighting to not let the tax breaks for the wealthy expire, and we're fighting to not raise the Social Security cap from $87,000. I think we're wrong.
Yeah. So, a couple things. on the cast. A couple things. I don't disagree with the premise of what you're saying. The question is, what's the best way to do this? Is it to is it to redistribute?
Lower spending, but it's a matter of there's nothing wrong with taxing the top because it does not trickle down.
We do tax the top. The top. Let's remember, most of our jobs come from successful small businesses. Two-thirds of our jobs. You got to remember, these businesses pay taxes individually. So when you raise their tax rate to 4.8%, which is what the president is proposing, I would just fundamentally disagree. That is going to hurt job creation.
Right. We saw how much the Bush tax cuts helped with creating jobs in this country. They didn't help at all. We know that. Since the onslaught of tax cuts for the wealthy in this country, since the Reagan Revolution, we have seen wages stagnate for the past 30 years. So Paul Ryan's notion that we are already taxing the wealthy too much doesn't seem to fly with his constituents. Sean Duffy, another Republican from Wisconsin, has to address the fact that Paul Ryan's budget essentially destroys Medicare. Listen, you can call it Medicare, but that doesn't mean that it's actually Medicare. Medicare is a government-run health insurance provided for everyone over the age of 65. What Paul Ryan wants to do is essentially give vouchers for old people to go buy it and to go buy private insurance. Try buying health insurance at age 65. See how much that costs you. In addition to providing vouchers, he wants to cap the vouchers. So as healthcare costs increase, seniors will be paying an ever-increasing amount of their income, mostly from Social Security, to buy this private health insurance if they can. And here's Sean Duffy trying to pretend that it's not a voucher system at all. What does he call it? Well, we'll hear.
I hear you saying two contradictory things about taxes. One, you want to reform the tax code so that corporations pay more, and two, you don't want corporations to pay so much so that they'll somehow stimulate business. So I don't understand that contradiction.
But can I ask that first thing for the next question?
I've been to the Congressional Budget Office a couple of times.
Sure.
A nonpartisan organization. The Ryan budget proposes to turn Medicare into a voucher program.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Well, that's my understanding is. That's what it is.
There's no voucher.
And the Congressional Budget Office thinks that's the case because they calculated the extra cost to seniors if it goes into a voucher program. That's going to be trillions of dollars. For those young men like this fellow out there in front, we're going to have to pay more.
First of all, it's a premium support. It's not a voucher. But let me tell you this. The bottom line is, if we do nothing, you can all say, listen, I ain't come and tell you, this is all fine and dandy. It's all going to work. You know, you can get it. And I don't know, any young people here, you can all get this program. The bottom line is,
if we do nothing, we're in trouble.
That's right.
Why we have to raise taxes on the rich and raise taxes on the corporations.
And then,
rich have never been richer in the history of our country than they are now. And you guys just cut their taxes again.
Okay, listen. I'm gonna tell you what. I'm gonna be honest with you.
He wasn't in when that vote was made, so he
no,
gets.
No, no, no. When you say
when they gave the tax break, no, he no, wasn't. No, no, no. He didn't get that vote.
When you say cutting taxes, if taxes maintain the same level and rate, is that a tax cut? No, that's not a tax cut.
Maintain the same level and rate of a cut that was made years ago.
So, okay.
Yeah.
And so here's...
It was sold on the premise of creating jobs by giving more money to the wealthy.
And there's no evidence that cutting taxes stimulates stimulates economic growth.
So there you have it. You've got this guy saying that, A, it's not a voucher system, it's premium support. We're not giving you money to go buy private health insurance. We're giving you money to support the payment of premiums to buy a private health insurance. And then he refutes the idea that the vote to extend the Bush tax cuts was a vote for tax cuts. The guy in the audience says, well, you were voting to maintain the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts. Well, if that's the way you're going to talk about it. What we're seeing here is the Republicans in a full rhetorical retreat. When they are questioned with this, when they are subjected to scrutiny, they have no rational argument. You'll start to hear them talk about fairness. It's not fair to tax the rich. Since when did Republicans talk about tax fairness? It used to be you can't tax the rich because they're going to provide jobs. But everybody knows trickle-down is a joke. Go to your local congressman's website. Find out when he's going to have or she's going to have a town hall meeting in your district. Go there. Email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you're not sure on what information you should present to them.
Bring a camera, too.
Bring a camera or any type of recording device. Point the microphone at the speaker, whoever's speaking at the moment. All right, folks, join me on the flip side at Majority FM. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. You can Skype me at Majority Live. Lots to talk about in the post show. See you tomorrow.